Hello, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Harry Mount, editor of the greatest magazine in the universe. And I'm delighted to have three fantastic speakers here today. But in the midst of happiness, we're in sadness because we have lost our very dear gentleman of the road, Wilfred Diaz, who sadly died last week, aged 82. He was also a terrible old rogue who stole from church collection boxes and did a runner from countless hotels. But the point was, he was our terrible old rogue who stole from church collection boxes. And he was a fantastic columnist because he had the crucial element of a columnist of complete and utter honesty about his own terrible shortcomings. But he was a great, great friend to the oldie and a wonderful columnist, and I always try to print one letter saying, you must get rid of this disgusting man, and another letter saying he is an utter genius, and both were true. So he'll be much missed, Wilfred. We're also very sad in the oldie office to say goodbye to our dear friend Emily Steer, who is leaving the oldie, who has been keeping Oldie Towers alive for the last couple of years. But on a happier note, I can introduce you to the world's greatest, funniest MC, Mr. Barry Cryer. Yeah.
I've just noticed what was on the menu. Forced Yorkshire rhubarb. I'm from Leeds. Nobody forces us to do anything. Yorkshireman who loved his wife so much, he once told her. Now, I'm wondering already. Oh, I heard a thing on the radio the other day, Trump in Japan, and somebody mentioned Pearl Harbor. He denied ever meeting her. I ask our authors to bear with me if they're not aware of this. A lot of you are. Our convention, before I introduce them, the parrot joke. And as always, I say, if you're tempted to join in, please don't. It spoils it for the few who haven't heard it. Woman went into a shop and saw a beautiful gold parrot. And she said to the man, how much? He said, 20 quid, 20 pounds. He said, 20 pounds? He's gorgeous. He said, well, I've got to be honest with you, he's got form, he's got history. He was in a brothel, and to put it delicately, he's got quite an extensive vocabulary. She thought, 20 pounds, take a chance on that. And she took it back to the flat, and she took the cover off, and the parrot looked round and said, new place, very nice. And her two daughters walked in, and the parrot said, new place, new girls, very nice indeed. And her husband walked in, and the parrot said, hello, Keith. Now, it's to business. Our first author writes a history of Britain through books in which that history is written, sharing our prejudices and attitudes. Oh, dear. A positive saga of fashions and feuds from 1960 to 1964. Book is enthralling, more and more, and more and more is what you don't need of my endless chat. Welcome our author, Christopher Tugendhat.
Well, I must thank the oldie for inviting me to this lunch to have the opportunity of speaking to such a large audience of people about one's own book is really a tremendous privilege and a great treat, and I'm very grateful to be able to do it. So let me tell you a little bit about what the book is about. And what it tried to do is to convey the British experience through the prism of books which were published during the years 1900 to 1964. I have a big collection of books which I believe reflect and illuminate that period. And in looking for a way to write about it, I was greatly inspired by Neil McGregor's book, A History of the World in 100 Objects. And he tried to tell the history of the world through the objects, and I've tried to tell the history of Britain through this period, through the books. And when I say the British experience, what I mean is the experience of the people, not the experience of the state. And I'm trying to capture the mentality, the feelings, the attitudes, the prejudices of that period in order to show or to convey the impact that they have had on the way we feel and act and think and so forth today. And in order to do that, I've approached the subject in a thematic way. So I've got different themes, feminism, imperialism, sex and relationships, the transformation of working class life over the period, and of course the two world wars. And I also cover a very wide range of books, from Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own to The Lonely Londoners by Sam Selvon, which is a book set amongst the first set of immigrants into London from the West Indies in the 1950s. From Elizabeth David's Mediterranean Cooking to John Maynard Keynes's General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money. From The Ragged Trousered Philanthropist by Robert Tressel, not much read now, but in its day, a very influential social tract, to Radcliffe Hall's pioneering lesbian novel, The Well of Loneliness, and then from Lytton Strachey to C.P. Snow. So it covers a wide range of themes and a wide range of books as well. Now, in a conventional history, what you're getting is hindsight. You get a much fuller picture of the past than contemporaneous books would provide, but you're getting history through the prism of hindsight. And when everybody knows how things turned out and who was right and who was wrong and which attitudes have stood the test of time and which haven't, they are, as it were, written about the past rather than from within the past, whereas the books I've written about, contemporaneous books, capture the mood and the feeling of the moment when the camera clicked. And I believe that if you mix and match them, if you read them in different combinations, if you look at them from different angles, they can throw out very unexpected insights into the period about when they were written, and stimulate quite a reassessment of people and of events. And just let me give you three examples. And the first is a woman called Margaret Bonfield, about whom very few people have heard. And in all the commemorations of women getting the vote a couple of years ago, everybody heard about the Pankhursts, they heard about Lady Astor, they heard about Millicent Fawcett. Margaret Bonfield was the first woman to be a cabinet minister in 1929, and that was by no means the greatest of her achievements. She was born into a working-class family, one of 11 children in Somerset, and in the latter part of the 19th century, and long before Mrs. Pankhurst appeared on the scene, she was negotiating on behalf of women in factories and on the shop floor, bringing about a real change in the lives of some of the most exploited and least able to talk for themselves. In the early part of the century, before the suffragettes were even formed, Margaret Bonfield was giving evidence to select committees in the House of Lords. Now, I mention her because not only was her achievement very considerable and overlooked, but it showed how even without the vote, it was possible for a woman as dynamic as her, from no background at all, to actually engage in real-life politics and really bring about change for a great many people. And it does seem to be a great pity that she has been overlooked in favour of these other people. It doesn't diminish the importance of the suffragettes and getting the vote, but it does show that there were people who were doing a lot of practical good before and even without that. The second example I'll give is somebody who, again, very few people have ever heard, and he's a man called Houston Stuart Chamberlain. And Houston Stuart Chamberlain was the author of one of the principal source books of Nazi philosophy. He was much revered by Hitler and by Goebbels and by others, and when he was on his deathbed at the Wagner estate in 1927, Hitler actually went to his deathbed. After after he died, Arthur Rosenberg wrote a book in tribute to him as one of the great forerunners of Nazi philosophy. It's rather salutary to think that such a person could have been British. When his book was published in English, it was published in German first, but when his book was published in English in 1911, it was praised on the left by George Bernard Shaw in the Fabian News. It was praised on the right by The Spectator. In the United States, it was given a very warm reception by Theodore Roosevelt. Now, nobody could have imagined at that time where all this would lead in terms of the Holocaust, but it is something which does give one pause for thought, that one of the inspirations for the Nazi Party should have been an Englishman. The third example I give is a very different one, and it's Evelyn Waugh. And we all know that Evelyn Waugh was a great reactionary as well as a wonderful writer. And nobody will be surprised to know that when he went to Kenya, as it then was, in 1930, he thought it was absolutely wonderful. He loved the white settlers. He thought they had just the way of life he approved of. He was all for the color bar. He thought he defended the idea of white racial superiority. None of that would necessarily come as a surprise to you. But what may come as a surprise was that in the book he wrote about this visit called Remote People in 1931, he forecast that European settlement in Africa wouldn't last for much more than 25 years. Now, that is a most astonishing piece of forecasting, and something which I doubt that any of the experts in the field could have imagined. So, as I say, what I've tried to do is to provide a different view on this period in the hope that this will cast light on the way we think and feel today. And just to conclude, it also, I think, certainly has made me reassess some of my own attitudes. It's made me wonder, for instance, how I would have stood up on appeasement. Would I have stuck to appeasement beyond the point of no return, as it were, or would my fears of a repetition of the First World War have led me to follow Chamberlain all the way through? I don't know. If you look at the book, which many people may remember, called The Golden Notebook by Doris Lessing, you may remember that the two women protagonists in that book agonize at great length over what's happening in the colonies. But although they were in the late 1950s, neither of them is remotely concerned about what's happening so far as colored people are concerned around them in Notting Hill, which was not quite like it is now, in Notting Hill, which was where Doris Lessing had lived until recently. She could see what was happening in the colonies. She couldn't see what was happening under her own nose at home. I wonder to what extent I am overlooking things which are happening now. I wonder to what extent my ideas are going to look outdated, foolish, wrong-headed when my grandchildren come to assess them. And the book has certainly enabled me to rethink in that way, so that I hope that if you read it, I hope you'll enjoy it. I hope it'll cast a new light on the day before yesterday, and I hope it may also lead you to reassess some of the views that you hold about that period. Thank you very much. Oh.